Today, we are looking at the Minor Prophets, 12 books in the Old Testament that speak of God's judgment and his desire for justice.
Why are they called the Minor Prophets, though? I don't know. That just seems kind of insulting.
Well, they aren't called Minor Prophets because they are unimportant, but because they are simply much shorter than what we would call the Major Prophets. Look at the 12 Minor Prophets together compared to the longest Major Prophet, Isaiah.
Oh, I see. Those are super short books. If they're all so short, were they written kind of right around the same time?
Well, these 12 books are written over a 400-year period that is pretty significant in Israel's history. Between 800 BC and 400 BC, both the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel are conquered, and these prophets are active either prior to the fall of these kingdoms, warning the people of God's coming judgment, or after their return from exile, warning people not to return to the ways that led to God's judgment in the first place.
Wow, so these guys are pretty important, even though the books are so short. Were these only written to the northern and southern kingdoms then?
Well, no, not only to them. The Minor Prophets reveal God's heart for all people in a unique way. They definitely include prophecies to the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel, but God also addresses injustice in their neighboring nations as well. He even goes as far as addressing the larger nations of Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. The Minor Prophets show God's desire for righteousness and relationship with all people groups.
These Minor Prophets sound like they have a major impact. Which one are we looking at today?
Today, we look at Obadiah, where God addresses the way Edom has been unjust towards Israel.
All right, ACC, how you doing? Man, it's so good to get to be with you today. You sound great here at the Victorville campus. I want to welcome you guys, those joining us at Asperia in Apple Valley. I couldn't hear you today all the way across town, but I believe that you're sounding great as well and lifting your voices up to the Lord. For those joining us online as well, we're glad that you're with us today. But we are continuing in this series, looking at the 12 minor prophets. Last week, Pastors Mike, Kyle, and Jackson all did such a great job over all three of our campuses looking at the book of Amos and really recognizing the character of God, a God who is just, and what it looks like for his people to embody that same character. And I love that great verse, let justice roll like a river. And that should be emanating from us. So great job on that. We're continuing. We're in a book today called Obadiah. You might not have even known there's such a book in the Bible. It's such an obscure name, one that you don't meet many Obadiahs nowadays. And so kind of a cool thing that we'll get to unpack. So if you have a Bible, make your way there. It's towards the back of the New Testament. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah is the fourth in our sequence. And I want to give you a couple updates while you're doing that so we can kind of all get on the same page together. This past Friday night, our board and staff got together for an annual gathering that we have. Sometimes we do it off campus. This event was here in our gym. And one of the things that we were able to share with them, really for the first time that I can remember in HGC's story, is an annual report. And we actually gave them copies. We have them for you today. If you're under 30, this is a newspaper. Okay, it's a newspaper. It's in museums now. We actually thought it was really fun to use this medium because it's kind of retro and cool. And what you'll see, you'll get one of these on all the campuses on the way out today. We have one for every one of you. We also know, by the way, never to give this to you in advance because during the service, this is how you'd be. And so we've learned a few things along the way. But man, I'm telling you, you're going to read this and you're going to be so encouraged. There are so many yay God numbers and ideas of what's going on at High Desert Church. We looked over this last year, September of 23 to August of 24, just last month, and our team did an amazing job. Without much lead time, we had all of our ministries gather some data that would be helpful to see what's God been doing through High Desert Church this last year. And then our comm team, with very, very little time window, got these newspapers printed and back to us. So I'm so grateful for them. I want you to know that we do an annual report not to pat ourselves on the back and say, look at us, we're amazing. Really, it's just simply to say, God, you are amazing. And what you're doing in us and what you're doing through your church in this valley, we're just so grateful to get to be a part of it. So see that today and enjoy some of those things. There's probably ministries you didn't even know we had and definitely ones on different campuses that you're not aware of. And so as you read that, you're just gonna be, I think, in all kinds of ways encouraged to wanna say, yay, God. Now, when I think of a local church and I think of even this season that is just so encouraging, it makes me think, I think in metaphors. So it makes me think of one of these. Take a look up on the screen. This is like something that your great-great-grandparents would have used to hold water. It's an old school water barrel. And it was for its time. It's really impressive. It has these wooden slats that all rise together, held by two or three bands of metal. And you could actually compress the wood together so tightly that it actually wouldn't leak. That's kind of amazing. Before all the world of plastics and the things we use nowadays to hold liquids, it's amazing that you could have a barrel made out of wood and metal that could actually keep water safe, a very vital, very necessary, essential thing for a family or a group of people, and yet it wouldn't leak and it would just do its job really well. So you're like, Todd, what was the point of talking about ancient history and water barrels? Well, I think it's a great metaphor for a local church. In that, different parts of a church, its ministries or its campuses or fill in the blank, can serve as these slats that all are joined together and as a result are sound. They work together and they have a capacity that they're able to fill. The reality, though, that's interesting, if that water barrel picture has 12 slats, the wild thing is that 11 of them could all be at the top and in the right proportion and doing well, but even if just one of them is lower, all the water that you pour into that barrel won't matter because the water won't go higher than the lowest slat. Take a look at this picture. So whatever the lowest slat of a water barrel is the capacity that the water barrel can hold. And it's powerful to me. It's real basic, you know, science, but it's powerful to me to consider that you can have so many things up and to the right, but one limiter that brings the capacity of the whole thing down. When I came back to HDC 2.5 years ago, conversations among our staff really demonstrated that the lowest slat at that time was people who were serving as volunteers in our ministries. And there were actually ministries or projects and programs we couldn't do because we were limited by the lack of people serving. Now, can I tell you, I know why that happened. You had been at home watching worship services in your PJs eating waffles. So just coming back in person to a church service was a big deal. And then all of a sudden, now you want me to do something more? For your whole life, many of you, you've been coming to church. It was no big deal. But now it's just getting back into that rhythm. And our staff did such a great job of reaching out and inviting you to serve in new ways. And I will tell you, our staff team today, 2.5 years later, would say that is by no means our lowest slat. We're doing really well in that area, and you are serving according to your gifts. Some of you have come back to serving. Others of you serving in a local church for the very first time. That's awesome. That's another yay God. And it's a great demonstration that just because a low slat is what it is in a season doesn't mean it has to stay that way. What I wanted to share with you, though, is that we have another low slat. And in this season, it relates to our giving, to our finances. And one thing that I'm very committed to do is to be transparent and to communicate well with you. I grew up in churches where we didn't talk about not only your finances, and that's a big deal at HGC. We talk about stewardship in all kinds of ways because Jesus talked about it a lot. But also a church's finances, that we were kind of kept in the dark about where things were good or bad. And I'm just committed to not be that guy. And the simple reality is this, I want to show you a couple graphs that have been helpful for me to try to understand how did we get here. And one is just a conundrum. It makes no sense. Take a look at the screen. And what it shows over the last 4 years, we have been continually growing in attendance. Our number of weekend attenders just in worship services, not counting kids and students, was 1440 back in 2021. It is now 2643. That's a growth of 83%. In 4 years. That's amazing. That's awesome. And that's so good. But here's the conundrum. As attendance has been rising, not only has giving not flatlined, it's actually decreased. And in church world, that doesn't make any sense. Usually the patterns go, as attendance grows, so does giving. And as attendance goes down, so does giving. Ours are inverted. And that's just a reality. It's no one's mad about that or frustrated. It's just simply a good, like sometimes you need to take a snapshot of something to understand why it is what it is. So again, we go, yay God for that growth. We also go, yay God, that there is $8 million that you are contributing to High Desert Church that we can wisely steward in our valley. That's amazing, right? So we never want to look down on that like, oh man, I can't think of how many churches wish they had $8 million to be able to invest in their valley and around the world. But then the other part that really helped make sense of this is I asked Pastor Evan, who oversees our administrative teams, I asked him to do some deep dives, and this is probably the most telling of all. Look at the next slide. And it's simply this: in the last 4 years, we've lost 1,000 giving units. Whether that's a family, whether that's an individual, 4 years ago, we had 1,000 more family units giving than we do today. Now, again, there's a really great explanation for that. There's a lot of churches in Tennessee, Texas, and Idaho that have wonderful high desert church influence, right? Because just like everywhere else, people are moving there. And there's even other churches in our valley that people have gone to. That's all great. But the reality is simply when you look at that stat and you realize that represents about $800,000, then you realize, oh, that math actually all makes sense now. So here's why I'm bringing this to you. I talked about healthy stats. You're going to see that, or slats. You're going to see that in our year-end report. And you're going to recognize this low slat. And the great news is, as we move forward, we're committed, our directional team, to three things. We're committed to prayer. We're going to be a people who go, you need to know this. We don't for a moment think that it's causing God to have sweat on his brow to provide for High Desert Church. He owns it all. So there's no concern that we have about him somehow not being able to provide for us. But the second thing that's true is that we're also going to communicate regularly and being transparent like today. And the third thing we're going to do is we're going to use the brains that Jesus gave us to be good stewards. And with the goal of by May of 2025, we're going to bring to our administrative board a budget that aligns with our giving. Now, here's the other thing that's true of that. Our giving can go up in that time. Some of you are members, and that was one of the things that we have talked about as a kind of a covenant, things that we will do for those of you in our membership and things that we would expect members to do, and that's to give regularly. Maybe that's not happening right now. And by the way, I totally get the world of inflation that we're all living in. You're paying double of what you did a year ago. That is just hard for everybody. I get that. Others of us maybe go, giving is a thing. I thought those buckets went around for like tips or something. I didn't know what that was all about. That maybe even just learning about what biblical stewardship, there's a way that you can join and start supporting financially HDC. But I want to keep that in front of you, and we'll continue to do that in the way that's up front and forward, okay? Let's turn the corner. Let's get into the book of Obadiah. Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament, so that's why this week we're going to encourage you to read it daily. Read it Monday through Friday. You're going to get, if you're subscribed to our devotional text, you'll get a text every single day. If you aren't subscribed to that so far, you could just text the word Bible to 64567, 64567, and you'll be new on our list, and you'll get these daily devotionals Monday through Friday. Monday starts out really great because there's a link to a Bible Project video that will give you another big overview of the book of Obadiah for things that I'm not able to cover today. So encourage you to read it, make it thick within your life this coming week, and let it just kind of pour over you a little bit. Obadiah, when you boil the book down, it really comes down to this. It comes down to a brother treating his brother, not as family, but as an enemy. If you just boil down this whole prophet and what he's saying to a group of people, it's because they are brothers to the nation of Israel. And rather than come alongside in empathy, rather than come alongside in support, rather than come alongside in resource, just the opposite, they kept throwing more gas on the fire. They actually heaped on more problems that the enemies of Israel had already done. And for that, God says, enough is enough. And he's going to bring judgment to the nation of Edom, Israel's brothers, today. And we're going to unpack that. What does that mean for us? As we do it, it just caused me to think about my relationship with my brother. I'm the oldest of two. My younger brother's name is Jonathan. And when we were growing up, I think very typical to all kinds of siblings, we would go at it. We're talking two cats in a bag sometimes. Really, just stuff I'm embarrassed by very much today. But there's something about having problems and frustrations with your sibling when it's just the two of you in your home, in your backyard, whatever. But there's something about when people would heap criticism or make fun of my younger brother and I added to it. That just hurts in a different way. So much so that I've actually had to repent of that and even ask his forgiveness as we became adults. So I own that, and I hate that about my relationship back then with him. To the contrary, though, is my wife. Joanna is the most loyal person you will ever meet. And I've known her for a long time. We started dating when she was in the eighth grade. So all through high school, I was watching the way she would interact. And this is how it would go. With either of her sisters, she's in the middle of three. With either of her sisters, she could have this problem. She could have this frustration. She could be irritated by them. And they would know it, right? And conversely, it'd be the other way around. But the moment that anyone else came up and would say something critical or do something unkind to either of her sisters, not to my sister, you don't. And she would just flare, and she would just be so protective of her siblings. And it's like, I can have problems with them, but you cannot. And that kind of protective, that kind of support, that kind of loyalty is so godly compared to the kind that actually kicks a brother when they're down. So let's unpack this book of Obadiah today. There's going to be much for us to see, not just in the historical sense, but even as it applies to us today. So take a look in your notes. Number one, as we dive in today, family conflicts can have long-term implications. Family conflicts can have long-term implications. Obadiah is only one chapter, so I won't necessarily always say one verse. I'll just say verse 10. Here's how it begins for us today. Verse 10, because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. And hear these words, you will be destroyed forever. Man, intense, right out of the gate. Well, here's some things, just factoids to know about this book. Written by a prophet, given by a guy named Obadiah. The name Obadiah is actually more common than you would think in the Old Testament. About 11 or 12 times it pops up, but it's really very difficult to understand if any of the Obadiahs in the Old Testament are this prophet. It could be someone totally different than what we have a context for. We don't know anything about him other than his name. Secondly, trying to pin it on a timeline, it definitely happens between what you saw in the video, that 800 to 400 year window. Many would think maybe earlier in the 700s, but it's just hard to know for sure. But here's what we can know. Obadiah wrote his entire words of prophecy, this judgment against a people group called Edom. Edom is the audience for this, and Edom were the brothers, we'll find out in a moment, from the nation of Israel, just to the south and east of where Judah was, the southern kingdom. And so the Edomites are the ones who are going to literally receive everything about what is going on. There's no mention of any other people groups, any other nations. Obadiah writes to Edom. And we're going to hear about this problem of being an enemy versus a family member to your brother. This is how it all begins. Abraham, God comes to him. His name means father, but he has no children. And he says to him, I'm going to, between you and your wife, Sarah, I'm going to give you a son, and from him are going to come descendants that you will never be able to count, like the sand on the seashore. Which sounds like such crazy talk to an old guy married to an old woman, and they have no children. But God gives them Isaac. And Isaac will marry someone named Rebecca. And Isaac and Rebecca will have twin sons, Jacob and Esau. The difference is they're actually born, though, Esau and Jacob. Esau's the oldest, Jacob second. And it's these two twins that come these nations, from the nation of Jacob, the nation of Israel, from the nation of Esau, the nation of Edom. And so we see these two, and they are going to be the contentious points within the story and within the prophecy today of the book of Obadiah. Yahweh would go on to say that there is actually needs to be a consideration for how you would treat each other as having these familial bloodlines to Jacob and Esau. Even to the people of Israel, he said this in Deuteronomy 23, do not despise an Edomite, for the Edomites are related to you. So God has this special place in his heart for this group of Edom that are not his unique chosen people, but still he wants them to honor that relationship. And so they would have all kinds of conflict. We'll look at some of their earlier conflict in a minute. But as nations, their conflict would go this way. This would have been weird words to hear in the book of Deuteronomy, because in the book of Numbers, just before it, it would have been these people's parents who were traveling out of Egypt in slavery who would come to the borders of Edom and ask, may we pass through your land? And twice they are told, no, don't set foot in this area, though they're literally brothers to these people. King David would go to war against Edom and would soundly defeat them. And even an Edomite, a descendant from them, would rise up against David's, excuse me, against David's son, King Solomon, later on in the book of 1 Kings. But here's the big idea. What are we circling around today? It's good to know some of the historical context. But the big picture is this, is that Edom were a group of people who were arrogant and proud. And even recognizing not only the familial relationship with Israel, but even more, they knew very clearly that God had a unique relationship with his people. And they completely disregarded that. Look in your notes. This will set us up well today. When people remove themselves from or place themselves in opposition to God's unique people, Israel, they can expect judgment rather than restoration. When people remove themselves from, like I'm no longer supportive of, or place themselves in opposition to God's unique people, Israel, they can expect judgment, not restoration. And this is gonna be the storyline that we're gonna see for the people of Edom. So let's look, and what God's gonna do, he's gonna first say, here's the problem. I'm gonna lay out the case that I have against you. Beginning in verse 11. On the day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth, you being Edom, carried off his wealth is Israel. The foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem. Here's this powerful line. You were like one of them. You're family, but you treat them like an enemy. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. And look at verse 13. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth third time in the day of their disaster. Look at verse 14. You should not wait at the crossroads and cut down their fugitives, waiting for people fleeing for their lives and killing them while they're on the run. That's what Edom did. Nor hand over their survivors in their day of trouble. So rather than coming alongside their brothers Israel when other nations would come against them. Edom didn't start the fight. Edom didn't necessarily go to war with them. But when they would notice the Assyrians, when they would notice the Egyptians coming to war against them, they added fuel on the fire. They sat and they watched and laughed. And then when there was opportunity, they stormed the gates and looked no different than these neighboring enemies who came for them. It gets so bad that when Jerusalem is ultimately defeated by the Babylonians, the Edomites were there to celebrate. Psalm chapter 137, remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Just egging on the Babylonians. Do it. Go deeper. Hurt them more. Man, it's hard when you think of a family member. It's hard to think that you'd want to kick someone when they're already so down. But this is what Edom was doing to their brothers Israel. And so God lays out this case and says, this is definitely what has happened. I want to remind you of what you've done. And then I want to share with you how I'm not okay with that. I want to share with you how I'm going to judge you for the way you have mistreated your brothers. We pick it up in verse 19. People from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau, meaning you will be displaced and others will come and live in your homes. And the people from the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. They will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. These are all nations under of God's people. The company of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath, and the exiles from Jerusalem who are in Sepharad will possess the towns of the Negev. All kinds of geography that we're trying to go, how does this make sense? We'll keep going. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, like they will be subjected to the people of Israel, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. God is going to judge you and he's going to take everything from you. You have treated my unique people, Israel, with contempt, though you're not far off, distant enemies. Your brothers right next door. And as a result, there's no mercy even available. I'm going to destroy you. Imagine Obadiah bringing this news. You have been in positions before where you're like, don't shoot the messenger. No doubt, Obadiah, we would believe, he's not an Edomite, so he's coming from a foreign land and announcing the worst kind of judgment against this people. That's the gist. That's the overview. It's one chapter long. But our goal in this series has never been to just go, this is what's going on in the book. It's been to say, so what? So 2,500 years plus later, what does this mean in our lives today? And I'm so glad you asked. So we're going to dive in. Number two in your notes, God's sovereign choosing of people is consistent with his will and ways. God's sovereign choosing of people is consistent with his will and his ways. That phrase, God's choosing of people, we're going to see in a minute, is another word that you could sum that up, the word of election. And we'll talk about that today. Go back to the text, we're in Obadiah, verse 17. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance, it will be holy, and Jacob, another name for Israel, will possess his inheritance. So he's saying, Jacob is still, even though Jacob's been judged, even though Jacob's been disciplined, I'm not destroying them, they still will remain. Jacob will be a fire and Joseph a flame, but back to the Edomites, Esau will be stubble. And when you put those in connection with each other, and they will set him on fire and destroy him. Look at these words. There will be no survivors from Esau. The Lord has spoken. So Yahweh lays out not only the case against them, but gives them the judgment. This is what's going to happen. And it's interesting that side by side, while he's saying there will be no survivors of Edom, there will be survivors, however, a remnant from Israel. He's saying both things at the same time. I'm not going to do this to every people group, but I'm going to do it to you for the way you've treated my people. And my people, even when I judge them for their faithlessness, I'm not going to fully destroy them. They are actually going to be the fire that's going to burn you up. And there's a powerful phrase at the end, thus says the Lord has spoken. So these words are powerful when we understand, and it even helps us to go back to understand not just where there were national rivalries and challenge, but man, it goes back to the very beginning. We said that Isaac and Rebekah have these twin sons, Esau and Jacob. But we read in Genesis 25, it's so clear, but Jacob loved Esau and Rebekah loved Isaac or Jacob. And so you see this challenge. Isaac loved Esau and Rebekah loved Jacob. Man, Todd is so confused with names. Jacob, that's right. Yeah, they're all floating in my head at once. When you have parents, just reading the text, you don't have to read anything else. And there was a problem. You know. That's parenting 101. You don't favor one child over another. And as a result, Isaac loving this man's man, this Esau, go out and hunt and take care of the fields. And this guy was what he liked. And Rebekah loving this son, Jacob, the definition of him is that he loved to hang around the tents. So you had these two very different personalities. Father was drawn to one, mother to the other. And as a result, great jealousies and dysfunction arose. It's just to be expected. If you start with the wrong numbers at the beginning, the equation always comes out wrong. There's no way that a parent would ever should ever favor one child over another because you're just asking for there to be fallout. And the fallout between them went this way. Esau was out hunting one day. He comes back famished, and he tells Jacob, who's making a pot of stew, he's like, give me some of that, which was obviously rude. But Jacob turns this and says, absolutely, if you just give me the thing that will make you the owner of everything later on, our birthright. That's all you have to do. Go to the store, $10 for a bowl of soup versus everything that's here becomes mine. Let's make a deal. And it's interesting, Esau does. He's so famished, he's so frustrated that Jacob won't share with him. He makes this deal. All throughout the Bible later on, they will say Esau completely disregarded the value of his birthright and as a result sold it for a bowl of soup. He's seen as a fool because of how he acts. But that's just step one. Then their father, Isaac, is on his deathbed and he's gonna give this blessing to the firstborn. He sends Esau out to go kill some sort of a game that's going to come back. He's going to feed him this last meal. While he's out doing that, Rebekah overhears, and remember, she favors this other kid, Jacob. They concoct this crazy story of making him some food. So much did Jacob not resemble his brother, they had to kill animals and put their skins on his arm. So when the father touched his arm, he'd feel something that was hairy versus who Jacob was not. I concoct this whole scheme. And Jacob, though Isaac's, he's blind, he can't figure out what's going on. But he's like, you don't seem like my son Esau. He gives him the blessing of the firstborn, only to have Esau literally come in right after Jacob has left and realize he stole it from me. Esau's not just mad. Esau says, I'm going to kill him. And as a result, Jacob takes off. He flees, and there he meets Rebecca, begins a family, amasses great wealth. And as a result of needing to leave that area and coming home, all that sounds like a really good option until he realizes, but Esau's still there. This guy has not forgotten what I've done to him. So as they make their trek home, he's so afraid of what Esau's going to do, he splits his family and he splits his wealth in two groups. And he sends one to this side, and he comes with the other to meet Esau with the thinking, at least if Esau loses his mind and kills me, he won't kill all of us. That's how afraid he was of that meeting. Esau was tempered, welcomed his brother and his family back, but they walked on eggshells the rest of their relationship, always concerned that if I just catch Esau on a bad day, I'm done. That's the tension. That's the tension that these two nations grew out of, that this family fostered. And as a result, there was incredible challenge and problem. But this book of Obadiah actually brings a close by God saying, I'm not going to contend with you, Edom, any longer for the way you've treated your brother. Another book that helps actually is another minor prophet, the book of Malachi. And in Malachi, there are three different arguments that the prophet is responding to. The first one relates to the nation of Edom. Malachi chapter 1, verse 2, I have loved you, says the Lord. So God's saying, man, you are my people. Now he's writing to a people post-exile. They've already been destroyed by Babylon. They were exiled there. They've come back. They're rebuilding the city, rebuilding the temple, rebuilding their homes, and yet they're griping. They're like, God, we can't even tell. It's kind of like that song, what have you done for me lately? So they're frustrated. Like, I haven't seen your faithfulness. I haven't seen your goodness, your abundance. That's the first line. He says, I've loved you, but you ask, how have you loved us? We're not seeing it. God replies, was not Esau Jacob's brother? Yet I have loved Jacob, but Esau I have hated. And I have turned his country, his hill country, into a wasteland and left his inheritance to desert jackals. I've decimated Edom. Edom may say, though we have been crushed, we will rebuild the ruins. They may build, but I will demolish. They will be called the wicked land. And look at this phrase, a people always under the wrath of the Lord. You will see it with your own eyes and say, great is the Lord, even beyond the borders of Israel. So this post-exile group of people of Israel in the city of Jerusalem are crying out to God and saying, God, we don't see your blessing over us. God says, well, let me show you in comparison to how I've treated your brother. This is the state of Edom. And as he walks that out, the people of Israel, God says in advance, when you recognize how I have blessed and favored you and cared for you, and how I have judged them even to the end, always under my wrath, you are going to say, great is the Lord, even beyond our borders. Look who our God is. That's the overall gist of the thing, but I read something in there that probably caused you to pause. And if it didn't, we should talk after this service. I read that God hates people. Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. That feels like a tension in my spirit. What do I do with that? Malachi, like most of the Old Testament written in originally in Hebrew, both of these words, love, hate, their root goes down to friend and enemy. I've loved Jacob, my friend, I've hated Esau, my enemy. Now, that's all still fine for Jacob, but still, God hating people, people being like enemies to God. Man, if he's so loving, how can he be like that? That doesn't seem fair, doesn't seem right. And so as you process that tension a little bit, I begin to think through what that meant for this unique people of Israel in contrast to the nation of Edom. There's something about that word enemy, though, that you're thinking in the back of your mind, but I've seen that word in other places in the Bible. And what if that posture of God being someone who is an animosity in an enemy relationship is actually true of every single human being still under sin's control? Paul would write this to the church at Colossae, Colossians chapter 1. Once you were alienated from God and were, say it, enemies. You are enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. Oh, this is much more serious than the nation of Edom being in an enemy-like relationship with a holy God. This is all of us. We were all enemies. And then it begs the right question. Well, what hope is there? What hope is there that we could ever be right? There was actually a way that people were trained to share the gospel in the 70s and 80s. And the way this went was steps to peace with God. It was an understanding that you're currently not at peace, currently not in a right relationship with a holy God because of your sin. I don't know that that approach works so well today because I think most people think God likes me a ton. We're good. The Bible would say different. And so what hope do we have? Paul continues in the very next words in Colossians 1. But now, though enemies of God, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death, the cross. The cross is the answer, the hope that we have to our dilemma. What? To present you holy in his sight. To present you as one acceptable to him as a holy God, without blemish and free from accusation, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel. The reason we can be holy before a holy God isn't because we're trying to be so good and religious and moral. It's because of the sinless sacrifice of Jesus on a cross that we attach our hope to that. That's it. That's the only way that we can be right with him. Otherwise, we are on the wrong side of the relationship. When we started this series and we said, Pastor Kurt and I were talking, we said, it's going to be kind of fuzzy some weeks to not begin to align the country of the United States with the nation of Israel because we're so distinct on every front. And we'll want to keep guarding. I said, what we should most consider ourselves is a nation like Edom. Now, we don't have a brotherly relationship with Israel like that, like literally bloodlines. But the reality is that there is such a unique thing that God has done in these covenants that he's made with the people of Israel that every other people group on the planet don't share in. And we'll talk more about his relationship to Israel in a minute, but consider the fallout of sin. The fact that every human being is born as a sinner in nature and in action means that we all stand on the side of God's enemies, apart from what only God could do to make us right through the cross. Paul says the same words to the church at Rome, chapter 5, verse 10, for if while we were not just even like, we're God's enemies, if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son. That's the exact same language as Colossians 1. We are made right with God because of what his son did, not what we're trying to do. So how much more then, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Paul says, man, God's done this amazing thing to move you from enemy, not just to friend, but to family. Sons and daughters of God. And he's done it through the death of his son on your behalf. Edom, when it says you will always be a people under the wrath of God, you can expand that to every human being apart from the saving work of Jesus. So when we read through these lenses of, oh man, how sad for Edom, man, we should expand that. How sad for the human race and how great a God who in our sin problem created a solution, created a way for us to be acceptable to him through the acceptable son he killed on our behalf. That's powerful. That's the gospel. So as we process these realities and we think of what it means, not just then, but today, This is a powerful thing to think. And then we therefore realize the very unique relationship God has with this covenant people, Israel. Now, be sure of this. God makes it so clear all over the first five books of the Old Testament. He did not choose the nation of Israel because they were so vast. He chose one guy and one wife and no kids and said, from you, the nation is going to come. From you, more importantly, the Messiah is going to come. So it wasn't because they were so great in number. In the book of Deuteronomy, numerous times, it also says it wasn't because you're so obedient and you love me so much. He says numerous times, you are a rebellious, stiff-necked people. I didn't choose you because you're so likable. But I chose you. I willingly made covenants with you. And ultimately, I'm going to send my son through you to be an agent of salvation to the world. That's his unique relationship with the people Israel. That's who they are to him, not just then, but even still today. So a big idea that comes out of this book of Obadiah, that word I said earlier is the word election. God's sovereign choosing of people. And it's important for us just to at least skim the surface today. We don't have time to dive into it like I wish, but let's skim the surface of what the idea of election is and how we can understand it. Here's a way that Paul puts it, and he goes back to the very narrative we're looking at today, Esau and Jacob. Romans chapter 9. Not only that, but Rebekah's children were conceived at the same time by her father Isaac. Yet before the twins were born or had done anything good or bad, track this, they were literally in the womb. Look what he goes on to say, in order that God's purpose in election might stand, not by works, but by him who calls. They had never had the opportunity to do anything good or bad. They're still in their mother's womb. But at that time, she was told by God, the older will serve the younger. I've already chosen the younger son over the one who's going to be born first. Rebecca didn't even know who that was going to be. But God did. And then he quotes Malachi 1, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. So let's unpack, if God has this way of choosing to bless and use one over others, let's unpack, what does that actually look like for our lives? Look in your notes. Election isn't about rewarding those who are deserving. Election is not about rewarding those who are deserving. And here's what we mean by that. We just saw it when Paul is talking about the example of twins in the womb who had never once done anything to demonstrate them, one being more likable, one being more lovable than the other. God had already chosen. And we saw that with the nation of Israel. God doesn't say, man, you're such an amazing group of people who always respond in obedience to me. All throughout the book of Deuteronomy, he keeps saying, not only have you been faithless, but even as I make this covenant with you, you're going to be faithless. That's what we said when we started week one. The minor prophets are all built on the fact that Israel failed to keep its covenant again and again and again. So it is not about a deserving people who are just so awesome, God can't live without them. In the midst of their sin and rebellion, God chooses them. That's the best way to understand it. Secondly, that's true. Election should produce a profound humility and gratitude. Election should produce a profound humility and gratitude. When you understand, let's move away from the nation of Israel. Let's talk about those who've responded to the gospel. When you understand that the human being sitting next to you, the human being sitting in one of our other campuses, the human being sitting in prison, you are no different in terms of your sin problem as anyone else. And so God didn't go cherry picking the people that had so much to bring to the table. Oh man, this person's gonna be awesome. I can't wait to have them as my son or daughter. No, God's election, his purpose in election stands, not because we're deserving, but simply because of his love. And that should cause us to have this profound humility. God, I've done nothing to deserve what you have invited me into. And this great sense of understanding, I am so undeserving. I'm grateful, God, that you would have mercy on me, a sinner. That's the right response when we understand that God has chosen us to not just hear the gospel, but even respond to it. And finally, in your notes, election has been a significant theme for us in this election year. Now, we didn't dive into an election year and do how could all these messages on election. But if you remember 1 Peter, all the way back in January, the very first words of the very first chapter, Peter writes to the elect, exiles, and all these different places he goes on to mention. And we talked about, as we understand ourselves as followers of Jesus, his church today, we are elect exiles. We've been uniquely chosen by God to be a part of his family, the expression of who he is to the world today. And though we are in it, we're not of it any longer. The exile concept is the idea that our citizenship is in heaven. Our allegiance is first and foremost to a king from another country. And in the meantime, we're to take this great news of the gospel and we're to be able to share it with other people who he's still calling into his family. I love High Desert Church for so many reasons, but the most glaring one is always back to Oikos. We are not a group of people who think the gospel cul-de-sacs in us. Man, I'm so grateful I heard the gospel. I'm so glad I've responded. Now I'm just waiting until Jesus comes back. No. I'm so grateful for the gospel. I'm glad I responded. And God, there are other people in my relational world, in my oikos, that you want to use me as a messenger. You want to use me as an ambassador. You want to use me as a person of Jesus' influence because you have more kids that you're calling into your family. We have been rescued to rescue. And God calls us into partnership that we get to have this opportunity that God could have done so much better on his own. But he's chosen to use us. We are his plan A. Let's wrap it up. Number three in your notes today. God's answer to sinful pride is humility and love. God's answer to sinful pride is humility and love. Verses 15 to 17, the day of the Lord is near, all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. Just as you drank on my holy hill, so all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and be as if they had never been before. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. So, as we see that verse we just started with, verse 15, the day of the Lord. Remember, we talked about that at length in the book of Joel. And we said the day of the Lord is fascinating. It's a bit of a conundrum because it's a dichotomy. One event can happen, and in that event, God's enemies are judged, but his people are saved. And so there's always this kind of duplicitous reality of one thing. The day of the Lord brings judgment to those who are opposed to God, brings freedom, brings salvation to those who are his. And so in that day of the Lord, Yahweh here through the prophet Obadiah is saying, my people are going to be rescued, but Edom, you're going to be judged. You have been enemies of me and of them. And a day is coming when you're going to actually then see the fruit of that labor. Look at your notes. This is a way of saying it. Obadiah's judgment against Edom communicates the problem with pride and lacking compassion for others. We've talked about it. Kicking your brother while they're down. That in our time of need, we won't find the understanding and compassion that we seek. That in our time of need, we won't find the understanding and compassion that we seek. Paul writes to the church at Galatia, this is true, it's an axiom in our lives. Galatians 6:7, do not be deceived, God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. So you either sow to the spirit or sow to the flesh. Whoever sows to please their flesh from the flesh, they will reap destruction. This is the problem with Edom. This is the problem of all of God's enemies as they keep sowing to please themselves, their desires, their interests, rather than God's. And God simply says, what you sow is going to grow. And you're going to reap that reality. You're going to reap the whirlwind. But instead, what did Jesus say? Matthew 7, so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. It's that golden rule you've been aware of. You might have not have even knew that was ascribed to Jesus, but Jesus is the one who said it. So in everything you do, all your approach, do it as though I'm doing for others what I wish they might do to me, even if they choose not to. Let's wrap it up this way. We've talked a lot today about the people of Israel and about enemies that they had, specifically even this unique set of related brothers in the nation of Edom. And I would guess this, in all of our campuses, for those watching online, there are as many opinions as there are people as you think of the nation of Israel today. We open up this series, conflict in the Middle East is nothing new. It's been raging for centuries. But in this current expression, where a war with Israel and Hamas began a year ago in October, as Israel has walked out this season, there are as many opinions as there are people about, are those things noble? Are those things the way they should have approached and responded to the attacks upon them? I'm not here to argue those opinions. I am here, though, to say one thing. We would do well if we listened to the words that God gives to the nation of Edom, that even when Israel isn't acting in a way consistent with God's design, God has not ceased to be a covenant God to his covenant people. That is something that transcends everything. It was true in the former covenant, and Paul tells us as he writes to the Christians in Rome, even related to our salvation, it's still true today. Listen to what he says, Romans 11. As far as the gospel is concerned, they, talking about the people of Israel, are enemies, there's that word, enemies for your sake. Meaning, they were trying to be right before God, between the vehicle of the law. God said it was always about faith and what I've done, not in a law you can keep. So they were enemies for your sake, but as far as election is concerned, they are loved. Why? On account of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. For God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. God is going to stay in unique covenant with this group of people through all time. Just as you were called at one time, you were at one time disobedient to God and have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience. They rejected their Messiah. So they too have now become disobedient in order that they too may now receive mercy as a result of God's mercy to you. This is where he makes it all make sense. For as God has bound everyone over to disobedience so that he may have mercy on them all. God has a unique relationship with the people of Israel. And the reality is for us, even in terms of understanding the gospel, God has used even their disobedience to be a mechanism so we can know and we can be a part of God's family so that God may have mercy on them all. Let me pray. Father God, I want to say thank you for your word. Even these skinny books, Pastor Kirk called them shiny pages in our Bibles that we don't often get to. We thank you for the message in the book of Obadiah, what you're saying to us, even as it relates 25, 2700 years later. We want to understand this powerful concept of election. We want to understand your loyal love. And we want to say thank you for including us. If you're here today, and you recognize you have never responded to the invitation of the gospel, can I just tell you there is no better time than now? Would you A, admit that you're a sinner? Admit that you have lived life on your terms apart from God's design and will, and as a result, there's a problem with a holy God. Would you B, believe? Believe that this Jesus we've talked about today lived a sinless life, died a sacrificial death, was raised supernaturally on the third day. And as a result, there is no other name under heaven by which people may be saved. Would you see, choose? Would you choose to bring the fragments of your life and set them at his feet in surrender and simply say, Jesus, it is all yours, whatever's left of it. I want to live my life following you all the way home. You can make that decision today. There is nothing in the way. And I pray you wouldn't let another moment go by until you do. Father, thank you so much for including us in your family. We love you and pray in Jesus' name. Amen.